Mike,
Hey,
how are you?
that's a scary picture, dude. It's a
Why am I
scary picture.
sideways? All my
I don't
pictures
know.
are up and down, and then I put it in here and it turns it sideways.
That's weird.
You don't like it?
That's frightening.
Pucker up, buttercup.
Yeah.
How's it going?
All right, let me get Chris on here.
Okay.
Add people to call. How come he doesn't show up like right away? He should be in my favorites. Add. Think I added you when I was doing the Peepway interview. If you had like a missed call or something
No, I didn't. I
by
didn't.
accident.
Well, I shouldn't say I maybe I did. I didn't notice. Good
Morning.
Good
Hi.
morning.
What is that picture?
What picture? Oh, that's Mike and Barb jumping up in the air.
What that picture is.
Oh.
That's the other one that I'm questioning.
Getting a lot of comments about my picture though, so that's generating a lot of interest.
Negative publicity is also good publicity.
Exactly. It's just a way to me wish you both a good, very nice good morning.
I see. I'm not sure if I want to wake up to that.
Yeah, neither is Stacy.
Especially with that pose. That's like something out of like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
That's my face. That's just what my face looks like. I can't help it.
That's not the face, it's the
Oh, that's awesome. Chris, how have you been?
not too bad.
Good.
Although winter summer seems to have disappeared quite quickly around here.
Right? I was talking about that at work. Or it's dropped, Mike, right from, the 80s to we're lucky if it hit 60.
Mike knows all about radical weather changes, though.
I know.
We've got nothing on Colorado. It's like 80 one day, and then the next day there's
Yeah, snow.
hail breaking windows. But no, I mean, I can't complain though. I mean, considering the wildfires and everything that are going on out west. Yeah, all things considered.
But it would be nice to have like a gradual easing into the cooler weather. Well, there's nothing wrong with like 70 degree weather.
No. But I think this year we're kind of beyond it would be nice.
Yeah, I suppose that's true.
But yeah, not doing too bad.
That's good.
I listened to most of the episode that you guys did.
Oh, you were the one.
Yeah, that was me.
That was our one
I was
download.
wondering who that was. I thought maybe
Well, that's a, I mean, I guess it's kind of a peek behind the curtain, as they call it, but that's why we decided to have three people on the podcast so that if one of us couldn't make it, then we knew someone would actually listen.
Listen.
That's right. Yeah, you missed my big video game talk,
Yeah.
which I finished yesterday. I finished that game yesterday.
Did you?
Oh, fantastic game.
Did
Great
you
ending.
cheat?
No, I didn't cheat. Nope.
So you made it through the game without Googling anything.
Oh, I didn't know what you meant by cheating.
Yeah, cheating.
Yeah,
I
I
didn't
thought you meant
cheat codes or anything
putting in
like that.
cheat codes or
I
something like
did.
that.
I was confused. I would say probably two times that I wasn't quite sure what I was supposed to be doing or where I was supposed to be getting some information. I did Google to try to find out where I was supposed to get information a couple
So
times.
you opened up your Nintendo Power and made a phone call.
I did. That guy answered the phone.
Answered the phone. How may I help you?
But that, I mean, like I said, this game is old, but it was fantastic. It really was fantastic. I'm blown away by how good it was. I would love for there to be other media about that game, whether it be comic books or like novelizations or a TV show, like stuff about the history of this world. I find it absolutely fascinating.
They had a comic book.
They did? Why don't I have it?
Where did I see it last? Oh, it's in the back. I probably have it right here. It's in the Jack Kirby Epic Life of the King of Comics. So if you got the free comic book day and you turn to the back page, there is a the comic book story of video games, the incredible history of electric gaming revolution. I bought it.
Particular.
Yeah, I have information for you, Rob, that is actually helpful. I don't know if there. I know there wasn't. I know there hasn't been a TV show. We'd all would have heard of that if that was the case. And they were actually looking into making a movie. I think, which I don't think. Well, they obviously didn't go through with that, but it does sound like there is a prequel novel. I'm not sure how easy it would be to get your hands on it at this point, but it was called BioShock Rapture.
Yeah, that's the name of the city.
Yeah, it was written by John Shirley, who's a fantasy sci-fi author. It says the prequel book details the construction of Rapture and the events leading it to its demise.
This is fantastic. It is on Amazon as we speak. Looks like there might have been a second one too. Just it says Rapture the Big Daddy. And that one is free on the Kindle Unlimited, but the first one is looks like $10 for either the paperback or the digital download.
Why don't you take the free one?
To think about. They're two different stories. So I'm.
Well, why don't you read the first one and see if you like it?
Yeah, I agree.
And if you don't like it, then don't buy the second.
Exactly. Yeah, seriously, I mean, it's this.
There's no pictures, though. Yeah. It's probably just text.
Yeah, I think it's all text.
Yeah,
well,
that's
there's
no
a picture
fun.
On the there's a picture on the front cover.
Yeah, that's no fun.
Yeah, they usually do those. How's that Stephen King book going, Mike? Made any more progress?
I'm still where I left off the last time,
Mike. What's going on here, Mike?
What? I have better things to do than read books without pictures.
What were you reading, The Colorado Kid?
The Colorado Kid.
Is that what it was called?
Yeah, no, what's funny is that that's actually one of his shortest books, I think.
Which one was the name of the one that you were reading? I forget.
The amusement park one. Joyland.
Joyland. Where's my Joyland? Now I'm concerned because I see the Colorado.
They haven't turned that into a. That hasn't been a movie yet, has it?
No.
They should make a movie. Then I can say I read the book and then watch the movie. Is there a Cliff Notes? Can I buy a Cliff Notes to Joyland so I can come back and then tell Chris, yes, I read it. Do you want me to talk about it?
Now I'm all
that shorter than the book.
Now I'm never going to believe you anyway. I just find it amusing that you even started the book.
Hey,
I just find it interesting.
I'm 3/4 of the way through.
I'm proud of you, to be honest with you. But you should just
And you know what? It's a good book. I could tell you what it's about. I didn't forget. I know where I left off.
What's going on right
now?
That's good. He just saved a kid. He was in the bear costume or the whatever the funky amusement park costume was, the dog.
Uh-huh.
and he had to take off his dog costume and rescue a kid.
I have to admit, you've
And
got
he
to.
kind of became a hero. Like he was, celebrated by the paper and everything. And he's still talking to that the mystic or the woman that has the crystal ball in the amusement park. So that's the
Talk a lot about white spots, but you have a pretty good memory when it comes to a lot of that stuff.
have a good memory for things I like.
I don't know where my copy of Joyland is. That's now
Like
I'm a little.
there's some comics literally that ever since I stopped taking notes, I don't remember what happened.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Like I'm reading Justice League right now. I started with 23. I'm so far behind. I started with like 23 and now I'm at like 35. And it's all about, Perpetua, and man, it lasts forever. Holy shit.
And it's very dense.
Oh, it takes forever to read it because instead of having like you have all this cool stuff, like they throw out like three monitor, well, two monitors plus Forger, which is really cool because they're all brothers. And Perpetua's kind of like their mother. And you have like Batman Unlimited, Justice League, and you have the what did they call the Grant Morrison stuff that he the 1000, Justice League 1000 and the Hour Man from the future, and you have all this like cool shit, but what do they end up doing most of the time? The Justice Society's introduced back in. And what do they end up doing most of the time? They end up talking like, "Oh, how are we gonna get the artifact?" Or, it's not a lot of action. Like the coolest scene that was is that when they ported them to like Pearl Harbor, and you had like Sinestro in a Japanese Zero, and Green Lantern and them fighting them. The Justice Society and yeah, but there's so much talky talk.
Well, I don't know. Like, are you reading through that? So, have you read, continued to read, like the new Dark Knight death metal, or
No.
you're going to read those after you finish the Justice League?
Yeah, I'll probably read
Yeah,
them sometime
that'd be good.
after.
Yeah, that's I
I'll
recommend
just
that because at least
stack them
actually after.
all because But I will read the it tied in like it the latest Justice League ties into it.
Yeah.
I'll probably jump directly through it. Like I'll just jump to it. That's how I read. I don't have to read things order. I read things in comic order, but event order not necessarily.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's some cool things. Like they have the Speed Force, of course, and then all those other weird forces, and the emotional spectrum, and all this stuff that they introduce. And there's like really good splash pages, but when you look at it takes a long time to read because it's Batman talking to Superman, or it's Lex talking to Perpetua, and it's just like 10 pages of that,
Yeah, it's very, yeah, very much so.
Overall, like, I like Snyder, but I like his ideas more than I do his execution. Just in general.
I think I just, or I mean, I'm sorry, I think I agree with you. I actually prefer how Tynan or Tinian kind of
Yes.
executes.
I agree. When he writes a Justice League issue and it's just him, it's not him and Scott, I like it more. Like I get into it. It's just like the beats and the timing are just done better. You know what I mean? Like he
Yeah, I
just,
agree.
at least in my mind, like everybody's gonna react differently, but it's just like you gotta hit the beat, hit the beat, hit the beat. He needs a little more Liefeld in him. Because Liefeld is the opposite. He's kind of like, "Oh, I'm just gonna throw in all this action and cool shit. Bang, 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 bang." That's what Snyder and him should team up.
to have a happy medium.
Yeah, have a happy medium in there.
That's true. Did you guys hear about the DC Universe app?
Yeah, but I that wasn't like a surprise at all. Like I knew it was
No,
coming.
I think the writing's been on the wall for months now, but I'm glad to know that they're keeping it around for for comic book reading.
Yeah.
So they're going to lose all their video stuff. It won't be a video app at all. As a matter of fact, I can't remember what date there was a date listed
That's
where,
January 12th or something like that.
yeah, there won't even, the apps won't even be available for like the Fire TVs and Apple TVs and stuff
Yeah.
anymore because there's literally nothing on there, video-wise.
But the
But
interesting thing is that the DC Universe app had better video quality than HBO Max, so it didn't make a hell of a lot of sense.
I hadn't noticed one way or the other, to be honest with you, but hopefully they increase that then for HBO Max. I mean, that's where all of their content is going,
Yeah.
so
When the thing started, I watched a lot of videos, but now it's just like I just use it for comics. Like I don't even it, unless me and Kyle go watch a cartoon or something, we don't. I mean, we just watched Jonah Hex on there, but which I enjoyed.
Stacy and I are finally getting around to season two of Titans. We're about three quarters of the way through the second
I
season.
started it, but I just couldn't get in. Like I enjoyed season one, but I couldn't get into season two because it has all that Trigon Raven stuff, and
Well, that's
I.
literally like the first couple episodes, and then it's done. If they
Yeah,
move on to
that's
like
kind of like the where I'm stuck. But
yeah.
I moved on to, Cobra Kai and what now I'm watching The Musketeers, so I
I have to
love.
say, I think Titans, this is just me, but I think Titans is the weakest of all the shows that they put out on the DC Universe.
I don't know. I liked season one. I
I thought it
really
was
did.
all right, but compared to Swamp Thing, compared to Doom Patrol, compared
Well,
to Stargirl,
Swamp Thing was my favorite, and it was getting better too. That's what the thing. It was killing me because it poked around like with all that Bernie Wrightson and Len Wein stuff, but then paid respect to all the Alan Moore stuff, and it was like this blend of both, and I was like. Ah, this is cool. So like if you're well read in both of the volumes, you're like, "Oh man, there's just like a lot of Easter eggs and stuff." And I was like really digging it.
Yeah, I thought it was great.
Doom Patrol, I haven't even finished season one, so
Oh, I loved Doom Patrol. Did you watch any of those, Chris, or no?
I watched the first episode of Doom Patrol. That was it.
that
Yeah, I mean, it was okay, but I didn't feel like I needed to keep watching it or anything. I mean, I don't watch that much TV, though, so.
Yeah.
But yeah, I wasn't surprised by the announcement, and like you, Rob, I'm just glad they're going to keep it around for comics and not. I knew they were going to end up folding it into HBO Max or something like that. I was just hoping that they would keep the comics around as that service, which kind of, I don't know. I don't know what they were really thinking when they put it together in the way that they did. It was if they knew they were going to do HBO Max and it was just a temporary thing and they didn't tell anybody that, or I'm just not really sure what they were thinking because it's.
I think the plans in place were way for the DC app were way ahead of
I agree.
were way ahead of where AT&T started to take control of stuff. In other words,
Yeah.
they started probably with HBO and stuff and then worked their way into DC and then they're like, yeah, we're saving piddly amounts of money, but we're gonna streamline our products. Like they're even streamlining their comic product for the most part. There's
Yeah.
they're doing a lot more mini series and one shots and less ongoings and taking away a lot of stuff. So they're trying to recoup what they've lost during the acquisition. Just trying to make their in all every area more
Yeah.
profitable, and they're trying to find they're doing what any company's doing. They invested a lot of money and now they're trying to recoup it. And they're losing a lot of money because they acquired DirecTV and DirecTV sort of going by the dodo. Except the only thing that's nice about DirecTV is you buy DirecTV and you can stream all those stations that you have. Like, so if you got TNT or any of those others, you could just go to the streaming channel and stream whatever station you want. So, you have Starz streaming, everything else. So you don't have to like remember to record a lot of things on the DVR. I mean, there's still some exceptions, but you could just go and watch it later. And HBO Max is free.
DirecTV annoys me because I used to have DirecTV and they just do not give up in sending you shit in the mail.
No, they don't.
It's just like, do you think by now you would have convinced me if I was going to come back? Like, just please leave me alone. Like, stop sending me shit in the mail. I'm not going to subscribe to you again.
You can. You should. You got some mail. You should appreciate the mail. You might not get nothing. I'm very retro. I get something in the mail. I want to go to the mailbox and get something. I don't care if it's an ad for tires or a coupon. I want to get something. I don't want to just open up an empty mailbox.
I like mail, but I don't want DirecTV's advertisements anymore. I
Yes, you
don't.
do. You might see what's coming out and then wait for it on Netflix.
Yeah, you know what? I'll start saving them and I'll send you a big box of them.
They
There you
could be
go.
collector's items just like the previews are now.
Oh my God.
It's
Yeah,
like the
sure, I'm sure.
They are. That Shuri preview? Good Lord. Is
That's
that a hundred? It's
insane.
$100 right now and it's just a
That's
fucking
insane.
image.
How is that worth anything?
And I don't know, but
Let's
I'd
see.
save them all.
Let's see in like 10 years if that still is actually worth anything.
No, it's not, but it's got
It
historical
won't be.
information. It's a beautiful magazine.
Well, I can see saving it if so you can look back through it and just
Well, if you're
for
going to
your own
sell it,
purposes and
sell it
stuff.
now.
Yeah, but I'm just saying it's not going to retain its value. Like something like you buy like certain comics, you can kind of, you have some assurance that they're going to, be worth something down the road,
Well,
but
you're cradling that line kind of like the first Spawn that appeared in the Malibu Sun. That's an expensive fucking book. That's more expensive than if you went and bought Spawn number one.
right, Spawn number one's really not that
And
valuable.
you know what Malibu Sun's worth? It's worth a lot more. So, and what is it? It's an advertisement.
Right. See, I don't subscribe to that. I don't care. That's not
I
their first
do. I
appearance.
do. I do
It's
care.
no, I
I
understand
want it
for
all.
historical stuff, but I don't need to spend all sorts of money because it's not their first appearance.
Yes, it
It's an ad.
is.
It is not. It's an
It's their
ad.
first appearance.
It's
I
not
just
their
I
first appearance.
disagree. That's the
That's
first
fine,
time
but I
that
disagree
anybody
with
can
you.
see the costume. That's the first time.
No. Their first
Yeah,
appearance
Jared.
is the first comic book they actually had a story in. It's not just an ad.
I disagree.
I mean,
Funny.
If an ad is a first appearance, then no character or hardly any character has its first any major character doesn't have their first appearance in a comic book because like they would advertise the comic coming out in the pages of
Every single
comics
preview has got to be worth
prior to that
hundreds
month.
of dollars because they have millions of first appearances in every preview.
I think there are exceptions. I really do. When you dig into like some of the young bloods and the spawns and all that stuff, they're
I don't begrudge anyone for wanting them or being interested in them. It's just personally, I don't feel that's the first appearance, and I'm not interested in buying it just for that reason. That's just me personally. I'm not saying that
And I'm
like other
personally
people
saying
should
I
get it.
do care about it.
Well, that's fine.
Yeah.
We just have a a different strategy when it comes to that, which is that's perfectly fine.
How many of those previews get thrown away?
I would say over 90%.
There you go.
Including mine.
Exactly. And you could have sold it for probably $50.
Sure, it was a long time ago, right?
I think it was her own comic. It wasn't like when she was in Black Panther with the costume. I think it was the Shuri comic book. Or maybe it's the Shuri Black Panther. It's the Shuri Black Panther.
Okay, because so I was going to say, I have a bunch of previews, but only from the past.
Yeah, this one's probably, God, this one's probably, if you look at the covers, do you remember when Black Panther fought Dr. Doom? They had that big war with Latveria, and then Shuri became Black Panther.
Yes, I remember when she became, yes. I thought that was really cool. I remember buying that that series.
Yeah, somebody was recently talking about that. I think it's 11 O'Clock Comics, and this was before the death, which caused a big stir in the market. But it was really interesting because they were talking about, man, what would be cool if in Black Panther 2 is if they made a war with Latveria and Atlantis, because you know Namor always had shit with Black Panther too.
Yeah,
I remember that was around the same time. That was good stuff. That was like political intrigue because it was like warring nations, you know. It was 2009.
Okay.
So
yeah,
if you look at the fourth volume of Black Panther, Shuri's on the cover.
I have those comics. I just don't
have. Yeah, so do I. That's 12 issues.
Yeah, I just don't have the like I said, I have maybe 13 months of previews. I just keep to see. Okay, well, you know, am I missing something? Did this ever come out or whatever? But after that, I kind of.
Black Panther is my second favorite character next to Daredevil. So. I have all of his stuff. The only stuff I'm missing is Jungle Action. That's the only thing. And he's not in all of them.
Missing quite a few for Jungle Action or not so much?
I'm missing quite a few. I have I have number 7 and number 5. But I don't have like number 6 and the rest of them. I have, I'm missing quite a few. And I think one of them's worth a lot because it's the first appearance of Killmonger, I think.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah,
Killmonger.
I see that. Number 6,
yeah.
Yeah. $200, it's saying.
Yeah, at some point and the one I can't believe I don't have, at least recorded, is number 23, because I remember buying this comic book off the shelf, and I must have read it like 15 times. I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually made a shirt of it, that image. Like,
mm-hmm. I'm looking at it, yeah.
Yeah, God, I love that image. It's like a retro thing.
Oh, yeah.
That was one of the first Black Panther comics that I pulled off the shelf, and God, I just loved it. I love that comic. But yet I don't have it, at least in my database. So before I got my database, and my database comic base goes back. It used to come in 3 1/4 floppy. That's how old. That's how
I had no idea it was that old.
I have been collecting that long. I mean, I've been into the database thing since floppy. So it's been a long time.
Yeah. I had never heard of it before you started to talk. You know, I heard you talk about it on the podcasts and stuff.
Well, I love it. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot more friendlier ones that are more, you know, usable for the phone. I will say that their stuff is kind of kludgy for a modern system, but for a database, it's probably the best in terms of just sheer amounts of metadata. It's accurate. They have, I don't know how they do it, but like when you send something, they screen it. Like they have people look at it.
Yeah.
And fix it. How do you send images? Do you take them with your phone or do you have a copier or something or what?
So if I've done any, usually I'll just go on the internet and find an image of it. And then save it to the computer and then add it that way. Well,
there's a lot you can't do that for, though.
Yeah. But so, yeah, I mean, you're right. It's only those that I actually can find one that I use. I've never done my phone or done a scan.
I've done my phone, and it looks good. But, man, I just can't get the right angle over the book. No matter how hard I try. And then depending on how you do it, you could get like a shadow over it because
shadow or glare.
Yeah,
glare. If you don't have glare, then you have a shadow.
Yeah, it's like nearly impossible.
Yeah.
I've been trying to do it for a lot of my Kickstarters.
Oh, you have? Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I've been putting my Kickstarters in too, but with just no pictures.
Silverline has been doing a lot of flip books, so I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah,
like, that reminds me of the 90s. I was thinking about like my favorite time in comics, and God, I have to. As much as I love Bronze Age and the 80s and every decade, I gotta say the 90s. Was for me the most exciting time because you had the death of Superman, the Batman breaking, Image getting created, Valiant, like that. And I was late in my life too. That was like college, man.
Yeah.
So I really latch on to the variety. Like, I guess before then, I didn't really latch on to the variety of stuff. And everybody wasn't fighting for my dollar. And there was a lot more. Like, it was just, everything was just blowing up.
Yeah.
All these companies coming out
Valiant,
of the woodwork.
Right at the beginning of the 90s.
I think the Ultraverse started there. Mm. So, it was just a... Man, I fucking loved it.
It's funny because that's the decade that probably the most amount of people talk negatively about that.
But they don't really understand it. Like, the people that talk negatively about it, they remember the crash. Like, they don't understand what was blowing up and causing excitement. Like, shit was big, man. I mean... There was just so many different things. You had things going in one direction for so long, and then things just started to change. And that's what kind of blew my mind, I guess. I mean, you think of all the 90s Vertigo stuff that came out, and I mean, it's an incredible time. Incredible time for diversity and artistic style and everything. Before that, you had your templates. In other words, the editors would say, draw like this. You do this. We had a house style.
Yeah.
The 90s is when everybody just started to break rules. And I like that. Break some rules. Do something different.
Yeah, I just think it shows that you form your own opinions. You know, you're not gonna just say what everybody else says. So it's just.
Yeah, but I don't even care
if people
don't
thing.
Like it. You know, I don't care. Doesn't bother me. I love Rob Liefeld. I don't care if people hate the way he draws feet. I don't give a crap. I don't care. They're not me. I like it. Screw them. I don't care. They're not worth listening to them gripe. I don't. For one thing, you guys know me. I don't like to hear anybody gripe about anything in comics. So I try to navigate towards people that like the medium in general.
But I think what Chris is saying, that's absolutely true, is that you're looking at the 90s from a place of a person like you said, that has read and taken advantage of the huge variety of comics that were coming out at that time. For a lot of people who just say, "Oh, the 90s sucked," it's because they don't have any type of depth in that particular decade. Like you were saying before, it's like
Yeah, they
they
might have
know the
been reading.
90s from the crash, from the
Right.
speculating and stuff like that. They don't know anything from the actual material that was coming out.
The thing that I find fascinating about the 90s, too, is before the 90s, people didn't become millionaires off of comics.
Right.
I find that absolutely fascinating. Like, people just made bank.
It's
And
crazy.
some people they still have rights. Like every time they publish a Cable or Deadpool, they have to pay Rob 5%. That's why back in the day in the 2000s we had Agent X and Soldier X because they didn't want to pay him. And now I wanted to search those out. A matter of fact, I've been listening to it and I'm like, God, I want to buy those because nobody ever talks about Agent X or Soldier X. And I asked him, I specifically asked him, I said, Rob, did they try to undercut you, like, and not pay you and make these properties? And he said, yes. And I said, are you going to talk about it? And he said, yes. And I'm like, yeah, I'm ready for it. I love this stuff. I mean, people were buying cars. I mean, they were just making money. And the thing that I loved about it is it took a lot of balls to do what they were doing. It really did. And then you had all these gimmicks, like how to make more money. God, that's just awesome. I love my protectors with the bullet hole in the cover. Like I mean, all kinds of different die cuts and man, EXO Man of War in that what chromium type cover. Oh God. I just eat that stuff up. I still love chromium covers when they come out. That's like my favorite. Acetate covers. I dig it. Cuz I believe I've always believed that the cover is what draws my eyes anyway.
Sure.
When I was a kid, if I saw a shitty cover on the spinner rack, I probably didn't. It didn't stand a chance. Even though the story might have been awesome and it might have had like all these guest stars, but the cover is what drew my eye into to pick it up and then thumb through it and say, "Oh, I want this." It had to have a good cover. It still does. I mean, well, no, it doesn't. I just buy everything, but.
No, but I mean seriously, when you were younger, when you were a kid, and you would go to a convenience store or wherever, especially before going to a comic book store, and that's how I picked what I had so little money, it's like I had to pick and choose. And yeah, I might have had some favorite characters, and after a while, I had some favorite books, but initially, like you're looking at those covers, like what looks the most exciting?
Yeah. But that's enough. We got to get back onto the show. But just a quick thing. You know how we did the class action that we had that discussion? The class action
Oh, yeah.
park. I was thinking about that and I had told you that my dad had, we did the Alpine slides. That was a big thing. And they were really dangerous. Like my dad cut up his legs. He got those burns that they talked about. Remember they said they had to have those sprays of antiseptic and stuff.
They said that was the worst. Well, that was the worst pain.
Well, my dad had that thing done. My dad went off the alpine slide, had to get sprayed, and then he went back up and then got the other leg torn up. Because he didn't learn the first time that when it said slow, you know, like use it, because when you're coming down an alpine slide, you go really fast, and it's like a silicone base. It's like a slippery thing, and you have some momentum, but there's these signs around turns and stuff that say brake or slightly brake. And my dad he just didn't want to brake. Like, he just wanted to open that thing up, and sure enough, he ended up walking down with his cart instead of sliding down because he'd fall off. But they also talked about on that show about the bumper boats. And that
You watch the whole thing?
Yeah, I watched the whole thing.
Okay, uh-huh.
But the bumper boats, we had those too, because we have these parks in Colorado. This was when I was a teenager, but we would go near the ski resorts, and in the summertime, those ski resorts, they'd have the alpine slide, the bumper boats, the all kinds of different rides, but they tended to be like more on the dangerous side. And the bumper boats, man, they're bumper cars on water, essentially, and you have a motorized thing on the back that guides your boat, and you kind of can steer it and crash into people. And my brother was, man, he must have been about 10, and you know, I was like 13, and they told us to bring the bumper boats in, like, your ride's over, bring the bumper boats in. And you would bring your bumper boat in, and then you'd anchor the boat to the dock. And my brother parked the boat, but he didn't anchor it. So, and I was walking my dog this morning, Harley, I was thinking about this time and how dangerous it could have been, because my brother didn't anchor the boat, so the boat started to take off, okay? And my brother, not thinking, right? He freaking jumped in the water to go get the boat. Like, he was dry
as... Oh, my God.
And then he like, jumped in, swam to the boat, but the, you know, the motor is freaking going off. Like, the motor is... Like, if he didn't time, like, the front of the boat right, he could have, like, cut himself up.
Well, he could have been killed.
Yes. And I was just thinking about it because of that documentary, and I was like, man, that could have been a dangerous thing, because...
Oh, my
Lord. He dove in at 9 years old after the boat.
Yeah.
And he probably wasn't thinking safety at the time, you know?
Like, no.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, going, it's like the motor doesn't have anybody controlling it, so it's like going in its own, however the current's taking it, you know what I mean? Physics takes over, so it's like, God dang, that could have been a disaster.
Holy smokes, you're not kidding.
Yeah. That's an interesting documentary.
It wasn't that crazy?
Yeah.
It really was.
So you went to that? Your family went to that?
Not
crazy...
to that. That one's in New Jersey, but they had them in Colorado too.
So a similar one.
They had alpine slides and bumper boats, but they didn't have like the crazy water. Class Action Park had crazy water slides that physics would say you could die in this thing. when you have to collect teeth at the top of the thing.
Right.
You know something's wrong when you have to have somebody, when a teenager, go clean out the teeth at the end of the day. That's not a good thing. When you have to pay your employees $100 just to test it.
Test it out?
Yeah. That's probably not a good thing.
That's HBO Max. It's a very interesting documentary.
Yeah, I didn't see it, but my wife was. I don't know if she watched the whole thing, but she was telling me about that slide and having to pay his employees to try it out. It's crazy. Just crazy. God.
It absolutely is. And like, I don't know what you thought, Mike, but I thought it was. I don't know. Like the tone was all over the place for the show, because it's so insane. that you can't help but like laugh at these stories and stuff. But then it gets real serious because
people die.
Actually die.
Yeah. It's got the funny tone because they had the employees and the people that actually experienced the park. Like, there's that one young guy, he's an old man now, but he's like, mm-hmm. he's like our age, and he's like, yeah, it's a fucking dangerous park, man. You know, like, he's telling you all the crazy shit.
And, yep.
and then you get, it has the somber moments, but they're short. Like, they spend more time on the ridiculous, like, this is like Johnny Knoxville Park.
Yes.
Instead of, hey, these people actually died. Like, they had that kayak, right? The kayak experience where they'd go down kayaking, and they had jet engines that would propel you down when you're kayaking. So it would give you, like, a rafting experience. Like, you know, you'd have currents and everything. Well, that guy got sucked into one of the jet engines and died. And they didn't... They didn't have like safety engineers or just engineers in general. They designed these rides because they thought they would be cool. It was like
The owner like, "Oh yeah, that sounds cool."
Yeah, it was like Jackass, you know, like, "Oh, this will be cool, man. Let's do it."
It was. That's exactly what it was like.
So yeah, it's a crazy experience for sure. And I would have rode those rides. I mean, me and my brother loved dangerous rides back in the day. And back then, you didn't care. I mean, you go down the highway on the back of a pickup truck, on the side of a pickup truck, no seatbelt, just hanging on the edge, never thinking that, well, hell, dad could brake and I'll go flying out of this truck. Like, you weren't even in the bed of the truck. You were hanging on the side.
I know.
And all it takes is one fucking like, oh, there's a hit something on the somebody crossing the street and having to brake, and we would have died. I mean, that's how dangerous it was. Nobody cared.
You know, you never, when you're that age, you just don't. You never think that something like that is going to happen.
But even as a parent, you didn't think of it. Do you know what I mean?
That, like, I don't. Yeah, because my parents were the same way. But like that, I don't understand. And it's like. Like, oh my God, I would never let my kids do whatever. It's like, I don't know if we, like, why we know better now, but I mean, we do, but it's like, it just seems logical that that's not safe.
Yeah, there was no such thing as a seatbelt when I was growing up. You didn't wear them.
Funny.
They existed, nobody wore them. The law didn't enforce them.
Yeah, we seem to have come a long way in understanding some of those things. Like, people didn't really wear helmets when they rode their bikes when I was a kid either. You know,
no.
You don't really see that. I mean, so.
I almost got killed on my bike. I had all these rear view mirrors, all this safety stuff, no hat, no helmet, no nothing. But I guess I didn't hear a car coming one time, and I cut in front of it, and I could have got killed. I mean, they yelled at me for about 10 minutes, but I remember that very distinctively. And I was only about 7. But a couple more inches, and I would have been dead. Like, just because I wasn't paying attention.
Yeah, it's crazy you think of it. Close calls that you have and stuff, like you read about in the news when something bad really actually does happen, but there's all the close calls that don't get reported and stuff, because I did pretty much the same thing. Like, I was riding my bike down the street and wasn't paying attention, and I turned, and I didn't get hit by a car, I hit the car. So
yeah.
I turned into the side of the car
right
as it was coming down the street.
Moving car?
Yeah, moving car, yeah. I wasn't going fast, fortunately, but I did, like, black out for a second, but I didn't, and I came to on the other side of the street, but I was still on my bike, so I just kind of, I'm not really sure what happened, but.
Wow, that's some serious stuff if you blacked out.
Yeah, or just, maybe everything just happened so fast, I just remember, like colliding with the side of the car, and then I was on the opposite side of the street. I was still on my bike, but my pedal on that side had been broken off. And like the side of his, like his driver's side door was scratched up from my bike handle. So I might not have blacked out, or just maybe just everything happened so fast that I, you know, kind of lost memory in the middle there of what happened. But, yeah, I mean, I was otherwise okay though. And just from being shaken up and stuff, but yeah, stuff like that happened.
Yeah, a lot of times you look and it's like, what the hell was I thinking? Like, we watched Teen Wolf and we thought it was cool to get on top of a van and van surf. And just think about that. I mean, holy shit, I could have died. I was on the top of a van going 35 miles an hour. Shit. What? Why did I do that?
I know.
I probably didn't do as crazy shit as Martin did, but I did some stupid stuff.
I was even thinking, it was last week that the kids have, there's two kids in the house behind us, and one kid with the girls 1 year older than my kids, and the boy is 1 year younger than our kids, so they've been like they are because they go to the same school, but they've never really played with each other. So they keep talking to each other across the fence. So finally they asked if they invited them to come over and play in their backyard. So said yes. And keep in mind, so we're one house from the corner, okay, from the street corner. So for them to get to the other people's house behind us is really just going around the block and passing like literally passing two other houses, and then the third house on the other street is the house they're going to. Okay. You know, I'm like, yeah, I think, you know, they're 7 and a half, like you guys go ahead, go, you know, we'll just call us when you're just call out to us from the backyard when you're there. Stacy was not comfortable with that at all. But when I think about what I was doing when I was 7 and a half,
yeah,
just up and down the street all by yourself all the time.
Oh, five for me.
Right? Yeah.
I would at least walk, you know, seven houses down to my friend's house all the time.
Yes. Well, we moved.
I'm talking like not in dusk too, like mm-hmm. at night.
Yeah.
Because I used to be able to stay out till, you know, 10 or so.
At five?
Probably.
My God, no, I couldn't stay out that late, but I was, but like you said, I was out.
And I was like, maybe, you know, more like seven, but
yeah,
when we were doing that, but I would go to my friend's house because he had like a basketball net, and then I think about, yeah, we're playing basketball till 10 o'clock and the neighbors let us. mean,
and there's no way that your parents could even get a hold of you.
Yeah, there was no phone. I mean, they could call. They could call my friend's house and say,
see,
hey,
if you're there. Yeah.
Yeah. That's when we had the phones that we didn't even have the phones where it had the rotary thing on it where you go, you know, you wouldn't like hit the button.
Yeah. But it's just funny. It's like, again, like things that we were able to do. And I'm like, I think they should be okay with that. It's like I said, they're just going over to the next street and then there's the house. So we let them do that. And I don't know. I thought that was,
it's a different world though, but it isn't. In other words, I think that bad stuff still existed. It just wasn't, I don't know how to say it, because there was that one time, I don't know if I think I told you guys, but I was walking to school by myself because my friend was sick. Mm. And there was an old pickup truck, a white pickup truck, and it was old. It always reminds me of Jeepers Creepers. Do you remember that thing, van or whatever they drove that? But this was a pickup truck. It was old. And this guy opened up his door. He was driving and opened up his door, and he's like, "I'll give you a ride." And he had a pantyhose on his face.
Oh, geez. Like
he literally had pantyhose, and I. You know, you're taught by your parents, don't take rides from strangers, don't take candy from strangers, don't do anything. But I literally just started running, and back then I was in shape. I was pretty fast. And I just hoofed it, but sure enough, he drove and, like, followed me for a while, and then he took off, so I thought, oh, I could rest. But he circled the block and then came back again, and then... Then I just said, fuck it, I'm going to run until I can find a teacher. Like, I'm going to run to the school and find a teacher and report it. But I know the intent wasn't good. I mean, whatever that was.
No, of course not. And my God, this guy
was a fucking guy wearing a pantyhose over his face trying to get me into his truck.
And not being subtle about it anymore either.
This was in the 70s. So,
my God, like, that's scary. I don't remember this. If I've ever heard this, that's a scary story.
I've talked about it before somewhere, but I don't remember. I talk about a lot of shit over and over again, and I forget I talk about it. But that was a scene where things could have gone horribly bad, especially if there was somebody else in the truck with him, because they could have got out of the car and grabbed me. Do you know what I mean? Like, if this guy wasn't driving and he had a partner, I probably would have been fucked.
Yeah. Wow, that's scary.
I knew the description of the truck.
Uh-huh.
And they called my parents, and I know my dad went and started looking for it, because the truck was so goddamn distinctive, because... It was old. Like, it was old. Like, it wasn't even a new truck. It was like a 50s truck.
Mm.
So.
Wow.
Never saw that truck again.
Thank God.
Yeah.
that's creepy. Very, very creepy.
Yeah. Well, let's get started. I'll let you guys get.
We've been talking for an hour. Let's get started.
I imagine Chris is dying to talk about a video game after we talked about video games.
I thought I might, but I'll hold off.
No.
I mean, I can think of a game to talk about if you really want me to. But if you want me to go first, then?
Yeah, go for it.
So I, for a while now, I have been talking strictly about 80s DC comics, and I seem to have kind of drifted away from that trend for now, although. And it's funny because I thought, well, I'll look on Hoopla and see anything that would jump out to me or look kind of interesting. And I kept seeing things and then be like, oh, wait, that's DC. Oh, wait, that's DC. And then I picked something and read it and realized technically it's not a DC property. Technically, but it was published by DC in the 80s, which is Dragonlance.
Yes.
Yeah. This is related to Mike's favorite, Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh, I love those novels, Chris. Did you read those original novels back when they were out, or no?
Yeah, not. So probably not when they were originally published, but I did read them when I was like. Much older. I mean, the original ones came out mid-80s.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, I read them not long after the original ones came out. But yeah, I read the original ones. And I was trying to figure out after I read this first issue, because this was later 80s that this came out. So it wasn't, those original novels were still pretty new. So I was trying to figure out how this related to them. And, but, you know, I've said this before. It's just one thing that's changed and that's kind of neat is just, you know, the creative teams on some of these properties. And this was written by Dan Mishkin with art by Ron Randall. You know, pretty good creative team there. And
Ron Randall is still doing work for Kickstarter. He's doing Trekker.
Yeah, he's kind of done it, like, he's kind of gone on his own, like, doing his own thing nowadays pretty successfully, it seems like.
Yeah, I think he's one of the most consistent Kickstarters, and he's got, like, a loyal following. And he's done it right. Do you know what I mean? He's done his Kickstarters right because people return. Mm-hmm. He's a heck of an artist. Once I bought the Trekker commission, you know, option where you could get like $125 commission. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so it was worth it. But I haven't heard his name in a while, you know, outside of the Kickstarter, so it's kind of neat to hear it.
Yeah, I mean, I think nowadays that he mostly kind of focuses on his own property, but so this does feature a character from the novels, I believe. Like, you know, it's been decades, so my memory is kind of, and I had to look up and sort of try to refresh my memory to sort of see how this. So I'm pretty sure this takes place after, in the world after those initial novels, which I believe dealt with the gods, the old gods kind of disappearing and then new gods taking their place, that were some of the characters in the novels ended up becoming gods or something like that.
I don't remember. Does that 100%. Sound? Yeah. I definitely remember that the gods weren't around or whatever, and then at the beginning of those novels, but I don't remember much.
Yeah. So Strum Brightblade, if that's not a D&D name, nothing is. I believe was one of the characters in those books, and it starts out with him traveling by foot on his own, and he comes across a woman fighting hobgoblins. So he rushes in to help her out. And after they've after they've taken care of the hobgoblins, she introduces herself, Reva Silvercrown. Says she's the daughter of a knight of Salamnia, and that she's heading back to her father's castle to warn them that she says the gathering clouds of war. So she doesn't really detail it more than that. But Strum introduces himself to her, that he's the son of a knight as well. He's trying to figure out what happened to his father, because his father sent him to safety. And he's only been able to find his father's armor and his sword. Riva's feeling a little unsteady after the battle. And so he picks her up and to carry her to a monastery nearby to try to find shelter. As they get close, she says, "You know, it could put me down. You know, I'm sure that you're tired too." And he says, "Oh, it's no trouble at all." And then he collapses. So then he comes to later, and they've put him, they've put him in a bed, and a monk with a hood covering his face says that they're in a house of Mejir. Mejir, it seems, is one of the old gods, a god of good. Strum asks if the monk has had contact with the true gods, these old gods, and the monk says no, they're silent to us, and they have been since, as they have been to everybody since the cataclysm. Kind of given some context, some world building, some exposition there to draw in the new reader. And the monk says, that we still believe and are waiting for a sign of the gods' return. So Strum realizes his sword is missing, and they say it's outside because this is a place of peace. Now that he's recovered, he plans to leave. He offers to accompany Reva to her place, to her father's keep. But she says that she's decided that she's going to remain at the monastery for a little bit. When she goes out, or when they go outside, Strum asks, where's my sword? And they point him to a little building outside, and he gets upset. You've left my sword to rust in some gardener's shed. And he rushes in, and there's a lot of weapons in there, and he starts sorting through them. And meanwhile, the monk goes over and lifts a sword carefully placed on the wall and hands it to him. Curiously, the monk seems to know Strum's oath as a knight of Salamnia. Strum apologizes for his outburst and ends up leaving. And once he's far enough away, another monk comes up to the one that they've been dealing with and says, and addresses him as Brother Brightblade, the same last name as Strum. And it turns out the monk that they've been dealing with is Strum's uncle. Riva's surprised by this. So we then switch to another scene, which is Lord Soth, a dark knight of the Black Rose, and he's a pretty iconic character. I remember his image, because he's only like, there's a small gap in his helmet, and you can only see, it's black, and you can only see little red eyes in it.
Yeah, he's like an undead, right? He's like a, I don't even know.
I think so, yeah. Some kind of undead.
Yeah, he died to like hundreds of years ago or something.
Yeah, and he's with a dragon high lord, you kind of have to, like, it doesn't just spell things out for you. You kind of have to gather it from the context. But it seems that so the High Lord is expressing concern about people who are still have faith in the true gods of good, Soth kind of mocks the High Lord for expressing concern about this. And we gather from the context that the other High Lords Also, think that this High Lord is silly to be concerned about people who still have faith in the true gods, but this High Lord and seems to be there with Soth because of this concern and knows that Soth knows that it's a reason to be concerned as well. The High Lord takes off their helmet and it turns out to be a woman as well. And I don't know, the panel is framed as if it's a reveal, and I don't know if it's just a reveal of the fact that she's a woman.
Yeah, what does she look like? Dark hair?
Yeah, dark, kind of shortish hair. She has like a blue headband.
Yeah, it's Kadiara. That's Raceland and Paramon's sister. So they're two of the, you know, the companions that try to save the world, and she's on the other side.
Oh, okay. All right. So, you know, that I think is something that if you don't remember, like I didn't, that's definitely something for the reader. And I guess, you know, the novels were a lot more recent at this time, you know?
Yeah.
But that would be an example, I think, of something that's like maybe not, a little too dense and not quite clear for the new reader. So then we have a scene, you know, and I don't know. I mean, it might fill in a little bit more in later issues, and for now, that's just like something for the faithful fan. I don't know. But we have a scene after that in a town where a couple people are preaching the old gods, and some soldiers come up and are rough with them, you know, and it's just kind of a disagreement we see more of this disagreement over the old and the new gods and stuff. And then another character, I think, again, it was a probably an important character, like an old Gandalf sort of guy, the stereotypical wizard with the long white beard and stuff like that, appears to help out the child of the couple that were preaching. But we go back to Riva, and she's with Strum's uncle. She's explaining why she's decided to stay at the monastery. She said there's this symbol around the monastery that she thought led her to believe that they might be able to help her with something that she found. And she pulls out this like this medallion that Strum's uncle recognizes, the sign of Mijir, the god that the monastery is dedicated to. And she explains how she got it, and Strum's uncle asks to hold it for a moment and confirms that it is a thing of magic. And she's Riva's even more intrigued by Strum's uncle, because he's, you know, she knows he used to be a knight, and knights are usually distrustful of mystic arts, and yet he's speaking the language of magic as if he knows it like his native tongue. And he just says, you know, I'm not a knight any longer. And at that point, one of the other monks rushes into the room and his robe's on fire, and they realize that they're under attack. So they rush outside, and there's like a crash of lightning from the skies impacting the monastery. And Strum's uncle starts leading the monks out and tells them to go into the woods to escape. And Soth and a bunch of Death Knights, like skeletal men on horses, are the ones that are attacking. So Strum's uncle takes the medallion and he uses it to cast a spell of sorts where these a swarm of insects descends upon the Death Knights, and it seems to distract them at first, but then Soth encourages them to fight on, that they're, you know, they're just insects and they're skeletons, so they shouldn't really. And he manages to even just point at one of these, like, it looks like a giant praying mantis, and it just dies from him gesturing at it. So that encourages the Death Knights, and they seem to start to get the upper hand. And just as Rivas, you know, the monastery at this point is burning down, and Rivas says, you know, things can't get any worse at this point. But classic last words, as usual, when a dragon lord, presumably the one that we saw earlier, arrives in the sky and on an actual dragon. And Riva's shocked because apparently no one's even seen a dragon since this cataclysm that they spoke of earlier. So that adds to the chaos. And so Soth and the dragon, they're looking for this medallion, and they're searching the monastery and not finding it, of course. Soth even looks in the room that where they were storing the weapons and stuff like that, and we see very clearly, even though Soth doesn't notice it in the foreground for us, is it's very clearly colored to be standing out a lance of some sort. And you know, if you know you're reading a book called Dragonlance, that might be significant. Soth and the Death Knights and the dragon and all those, they do end up leaving and not finding Strum's uncle or Riva. And the issue ends with Strum going into the shed and grabbing that lance we said. And we saw, and he said, not even Soth saw it, that which he and all his minions ought fear most, the dragon lance. And that's the last panel. So yeah, I mean, the I really liked Ron Randall's work. Everything looks really tight, and he does a good job with the fantasy style. It's a good, it was an entertaining story. Like I said, it is a little dense at moments. And I think some of the stuff clearly, like as Rob was able to fill in, but if you're not up on Dragonlance, then, you know, there's some moments that maybe the impact is not what it could be. And I still feel like you can gather enough from context to enjoy the issue and understand what's going on. You definitely feel like you're jumping into something that has a history, mm-hmm. But it doesn't necessarily, it's not necessarily something you can't follow. It's just, I can see how if you really knew the history, you might get even more out of it. But
yeah, I would imagine.
What issue was this?
Just number one.
Number one?
I would imagine that's probably, you know, give you some more of that information, you know, in the next couple issues as well, that it's significant.
Yeah.
Do you have this, Rob?
No.
That surprises me.
No, I wasn't getting these back in the 80s. I was just, you know, I had to pick and choose what I was buying, and I was...
It was mostly Marvel.
No, it was DC too, but I had to make sure I was keeping up with the actual superhero continuity. And this would be an easy one that, even if I had started it, that if money became tight,
that I'd be able to drop because it wouldn't impact, you know, my knowledge of what was going on in the DC universe.
Yeah.
Yeah, it seems like IDW collected this recently.
IDW has Dragonlance Chronicles as well, and I don't know if that's the same or something different, but the Chronicles were basically that was just adaptation of the novels.
Yeah, I saw that too on Hoopla. Those
I do have.
Yeah, where this was, this is more of a continuation.
Gotcha.
So, I might have refreshed my memory to read the other stuff first, but I was intrigued by the creative team on this, where I didn't really recognize the names on the Chronicles, I don't think. So.
Yeah.
Wants to go next?
I can.
Okay.
I was just bringing up because I know they had TSR had a license with DC, so they had a few things. They had Dragonlance, they had Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, which again I have like an issue here, issue there, but it's more like picking them up in quarter or dollar bins than anything.
I actually have the first six.
Do you? I have number three. That's all I have.
Yeah, I bought them off the shelf.
Got number three and number eight.
And that's when I said, fantasy, not for me. But I bought all kinds of stuff, like Warlord and Conqueror of the Barren Earth and Dragonlance and Dungeons and Dragons. I just never finished the Dungeons and Dragons and Dragonlance.
I mean, it's funny, because you do like some of that stuff, but it's more, I think it's more grounded, like the Conan and stuff like that, and Red Sonja. It's much more grounded fantasy storytelling.
Yeah, when you get into like closer to role play, I just don't get it.
It's not your thing. It's not your
jam. But I have enjoyed a couple of like Dungeons and Dragons comics.
Yeah.
Because sometimes I can, even if I don't care about the video game, I'll buy the comic and I'll like it. So I never know.
Yeah. Exactly. So the first one I've got today is Young Justice number 30 from 2001, and it's just a random issue that I have in a couple. I've got a bunch of boxes downstairs of just comics that I've just obtained over the past several years, but I haven't read yet. So this one, I've been really enjoying. It's funny, I enjoy the stories and the new Young Justice that Bendis has been doing, but I don't necessarily agree with all like the decisions that he's doing in the story. Like, he's telling the stories really well and they're enjoyable, but I don't necessarily am happy about in some of the directions that he's taking.
I'd say the same thing with Legion.
Yeah.
I enjoy the stories, but I don't necessarily like the direction, but I'm still enjoying it.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm the exact same way. It's so weird. I don't remember feeling that way before. Huh?
That's the way I felt about Avengers too. I mean, anytime that Bendis does a team book, I sort of feel, I don't know, it has some vibe to it that I was like, I like it, but I don't. Like, there's aspects I don't. But when he's more on an individual, I tend to like it a little bit more.
Yeah, I would agree with that, for sure. So this one, back from 2001... is I'm trying to find the credits on here. It's not on the first couple pages. But I believe Peter David, here it is. Peter David was the writer, and Todd Nauck, N-A-U-C-K, penciler. And apparently this is kind of a, maybe not the best issue for me to cover, because it was kind of like a in-between issue. It's apparent that they just get back at the beginning of this issue from Apocalypse, and they're driving the Forever People's, I don't know what you call their cycle, super cycle. And they said that they could use it. I actually said that they could keep it. So, right now, Young Justice is Robin, Tim Drake, Impulse, Superboy, Connor Kent, and a girl by the name of The Secret, and two other people who I don't recognize at all. So I don't, and they didn't play much of a part in this particular issue, so I'm not even sure who they were. But anyhow, the focus of this story is, it really does focus a lot on Robin and his relationship with Spoiler. And if you remember, Robin had his own series going on at the time that kind of delved deeper into this. But basically in this one, Spoiler is tracking Robin as he's leaving to go back home. And at this time, he knows that Stephanie is Spoiler, but he is not willing to reveal his identity. So this is kind of this is really getting under her skin, because he knows everything about her, and she's supposedly dating him, but she doesn't even know his real name, and she doesn't feel that that's fair, or that's a fair playing field, and what have you. So she starts following him. And of course, him being Robin, he ends up, as she's standing on the rooftop watching to see where he went next, he ends up tapping her on the shoulder, standing behind her. So, they start getting into quite a conversation about that, about exactly that like he's talking to her and sometimes calling her Spoiler, sometimes calling her Stephanie. And she's like, that must be really nice. And he's like, what? And she's like, you get to choose what you want to call me. Call me Spoiler. You can call me Stephanie, whatever. Like, I don't have any idea who you are. And, they get into it some more. And she tries to convince him that she wasn't following him, even though she was. And they ended up going their own ways. And she gets back home and she's writing in her diary. And suddenly that hero from Young Justice called Secret shows up. And I guess she's, Mike, I don't know if you know much about her, or if you do, Chris, but I guess she's got she's like a mist or something like that. But she comes out of nowhere and she's, just appearing out of this mist. And apparently she was hanging out and reading her diary, and starts screaming at her and yelling at her that, you're being so spoiled, and don't you know that Robin's got other secrets to protect, and so on and so forth. And they actually start getting into it and start fighting each other, and so Robin ends up calling Connor, and just they were just talking, he's kind of like venting about the whole Stephanie situation and stuff. And then he kind of remembers the conversation that he had with the Secret before he took off, just beforehand. He's like, oh no. He's like, you don't suppose that she went to go confront Stephanie. And so he makes his way back there, and he finds himself right in the middle of this battle that's just going back and forth now outside of Stephanie's home. And they're going and, Stephanie's trying to defend herself. The Secret's pointing out that, you're so upset that I read your diary, but aren't you trying to kind of do the same thing with Robin? And finally, Stephanie actually, as Secret is coming at her in a cloud of mist, ends up severing some power lines that the Secret's blowing through, and kind of zaps her. And at first she wonders if she's accidentally hurt her very badly or even killed her, when she pops back out and they continue the fight. So that's definitely not what's going on. They make their way to a construction site where they're building a tower. And they continue their argument and their fight, when suddenly Red Tornado, and if I remember, because I didn't read much, Young Justice, but he was like the mentor of the group. He starts with his tornado powers, sucking the secret into like a whirlwind where she's just going around and around and around and can't escape. And Robin's there with Red Tornado and stops and talks to Steph to make sure that she's okay. And then Red Tornado lets the secret go, and they basically, Robin, you know, sits down and tries to explain what exactly, you know, why he can't give out this information. He's like, listen, Batman trusts me with all of his secrets, and that's why we're effective, and that's why the relationship works, and I can't violate his trust. And they go on and on, and then finally he says, you know, do you understand? And they both say that they guess so, and he says, let's shake hands and promise to be friends. And so they spoiler in secret shake hands, and behind their back they're crossing their fingers. And so that's the end of this issue. Again, I've read almost no Young Justice from this time frame, so like I said, I wasn't even sure who some of these characters were. But it definitely was an entertaining issue, something that I wouldn't mind going back and reading more of at some point. But that might only be like the second issue that I've ever read of Young Justice.
Yeah, it's a very lighthearted series.
Yeah, yeah, it seems that. And, you know, something that I could, you know, easily pick up in the app or something like that and pursue at some point.
Yeah, it's probably there just to see if you like it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but it was cool. I enjoyed reading it, that's for sure.
Yeah, they had Arianette, who was the archer. I don't know if she was in that one.
Yeah, she was showing up in the book, but it seemed like either she was part of she's helped the group out but didn't want to pursue it, or she hasn't helped them out yet and they want her to. But Cassie, actually, there's a brief interlude where Cassie stops over at her house and she's afraid that she's going to ask her to, you know, suit up or whatever. So I guess whatever's happening right now, Arrowette is not interested in doing the superhero thing, at least as of that issue, because they kind of have it's only like a two-page little interlude, but she doesn't want to join the group, at least at this point. It was good.
Cool. Well, I'm gonna change things up a little bit from your DC guys, and I'll go with Marvel. I'm gonna go with Marvel Heavy Hitters, Epic Comic. What's the year on this thing? 1993. I'm gonna go to the 90s, and it's called War Man. Blood, drugs, and guns in the heart of the jungle. It's only two issues, but because I like the first one so much, I am going to do a My Comic Shop and get a number two, because I really want to find out what goes on here. But this is by Chuck Dixon and Juan Zanotto, and it's sort of like a Punisher character, except it's more like... He doesn't go after bad guys. He doesn't go after good guys. He's an arms dealer. Mm-hmm. So he deals in arms, and he sells a bunch of arms. The scene opens up with him dealing a bunch of arms to a bunch of drug guys. And he's got a partner. She's blonde, very sexy, has a short buzz cut. And, there's a guy watching this deal go down, and he looks like he might be there to shoot somebody, or I don't know what. He doesn't look like he's spying on him, and she basically puts a gun to his crotch and says, you know, hey, you better not do anything. So she's like his protector in this comic. And they're making the deal, and they said, yep, did you bring the money? And he goes, nope, but I got something better than money. He opens up the case, and it's pounds of cocaine. And he said, this is worth way more than the cash that you'll get. And he says, I don't want to deal drugs. I want the cash. So bring me the cash back to the hotel room. Cut to the scene later on when he just finishes having sex with that that blonde bombshell, and he's in bed. He's in bed with a bunch of the money, like stacks of money, and he's saying, "You're gonna have to take the money across. I got something else he needs to do. He needs to do something with the arms." So he goes on this flight. Well, there's this guy that's going after the drug lords, this politician. His name is Justice Alfredo Valtaires. And he's on this flight. There's also a couple of assholes on the flight. And they get on this flight. And it looks like they get shot out of the air because somebody commissions them to take this judge out. Well, the plane doesn't crash. It goes into the jungle. About half the people survive amongst this arms dealer and the couple that's the assholes and the justice guy, the guy that's going to take down the drug lord. And this guy sort of takes ownership, gets his guns out of the case that he had on. I don't know how the heck he got guns on the airplane, but they were being transported. I guess you could transport guns. I don't know. But he went and found his luggage, got all the drugs, and teamed up with this one guy. And it's sort of like Survivor. Like, they're trying to keep this party alive. They leave these a party of people, survivors, a lot of them are injured, on the base of the crash, and they say, "Stay here, it should be safe, you could build a shelter, we're gonna go get help." And so the guy with the guns and the other guys take off. Meanwhile, that one asshole, and I think it's his wife, they steal all the food from these people, and they make off into the jungle, and that's how it sort of ends, other than the drug lord finds out that the plane didn't, that it crashed and there are survivors, so he's sending out a bounty hunter in there to kill that justice. And it's really cool, man. I dig it. The art is really awesome. The story is really like a movie, and it's only two issues. I can't imagine what's going to happen in the next one, but we'll find out because I want to order it.
That's cool. So it's just issue one that you have?
Yeah. It's only two issues.
Yeah. Does it come with the trading cards?
Yes. The issue I have, I guess in the middle of the comic book, it comes with the heavy hitter trading card. And it says collect all 23. And I don't have too many heavy hitters comics. Oh, I do have Sex and Violence. I did buy that. It's spelled S-A-C-H-S and Violins.
Oh, I think I remember seeing
Yeah,
that.
It's a Peter David one, I think.
Nice.
Yeah. So, Chris?
Briefly, I think, on this one. So I really, as far as comics go, I haven't been reading a lot, but I have been reading a manga. So Japanese comics, they are, as people, some people probably know, they're published kind of differently. We over here pretty much get them as collections, but in Japan they're published, the chapters, which would be the kind of the equivalent of an issue, are published in magazines, and they're like kind of anthology style. And probably the biggest one that's, the magazines are usually targeted at different audiences, because in Japan, there's comic reading is a little bit more like diverse in the type of people that it attracts and stuff, and there's more of like a history in their culture of people reading comics and stuff. But still, like, it seems like some of the most popular, and ones that have achieved the most popular over here are the ones that are like arguably superheroes, are the ones that are like directed towards young males. So Shonen Jump, you know, that's a big one that a lot of people, that has probably achieved most success in America. And so they, Shonen Jump, they came out with their own Marvel Unlimited kind of thing, where they have almost all their back catalog, and then they actually publish new chapters of the stuff that's appearing in new issues of Shonen Jump not long after they're published in Japan, translated into English. And it's super cheap. It's like, I think like $2 a month or something like that. So I started reading Death Note on here, which is already finished. I think it came out in like the early 2000s. It's 108 chapters altogether. And I'm about like, I'm a little over halfway through now. It's, I think, a pretty well-known comic. And it's been, like a lot of manga, it's been adapted into a pretty well-known anime. There's some live action films, and I think they even made an American film adapting the story, which I don't think had very good reviews. But so I'll just talk about the first chapter, which gives the setup for the story. The chapter is called Boredom. And it starts out in the realm of the Shinigami, which I think is a pretty like well-known thing from Japanese folklore. But it's like, they're basically like demons. And there's a couple demons that are like playing some kind of like game, like rolling literal bones. And there's a demon named Ryuk. I think I'm saying that right. It's R-Y-U-K. So he's talking to the other demons. They're like, "Where are you going?" And he says, "I dropped my Death Note." And the other demons are like, "Wow, you really screwed up." They're like, "Where do you think you dropped it?" And he's like, "The human world." And they're like, "What?" So we see him like go through a portal, and he comes out into the human world. And then we switch to a teenage boy named Light Yagami. He's 17 years old, and he's like daydreaming in class, and he looks out the school window, and he sees a notebook laying outside. So like after things let out, he goes outside and he picks it up, and it says Death Note on the cover. And he's like, "What the heck is this?" basically. And he opens it up, and there's some instructions. But he's like, "Oh, they're all in English. What a pain." Which is kind of funny in translation, because you're reading it in English. But it's clear enough, you know, it's not originally in English. But yeah, the books in the instructions in it and the cover or something. But he knows enough English that he's able to, you know, read it. It's just not as easy as reading Japanese for him. So he starts reading it. Says, you know, basically tells him, you know, if you write someone's name in this book, they'll die. But it's not going to work unless you know what they look like as well. So, you know, it kind of gets around the whole, like, people have the same name, so you can't just write somebody's a random name. Like, you have to have picture somebody in your mind. If you write down how they die, it'll happen that way. Otherwise, they'll just die as a heart attack. And he thinks, you know, it's just a joke. It's just a prank, some kind of weird thing. And he goes to sleep and just forgets about it. And then, like, 5 days later, he comes home. And in the meantime, like, we get some more details about his life, and we tell that he's just, like, super, super smart. So he goes up to his room, and he's just, like, picks up the Death Note, looks at it again, and he's like, and then he hears a voice behind him and says, "You seem to like it." And he turns around and he sees the Shinigami, Ryuk, and so he screams, like, "You, what if you saw this giant demon in your room?"
Aye! And
it sounds like you have first-hand experience, Mike.
No, but I've been reading a lot of manga, so I kind of imagined what it was like.
Yeah, it's actually written ARG, A-A-A-R-G-H. But so he falls out of his chair, and he's like, "A Shinigami," he Light recovers, and he says, "I'm not surprised to see you. In fact, I've been waiting for you." So he goes, "Plus, there's some things I wanted to ask you." And he opens up the notebook, and there's just tons of names written in it. And the Shinigami is impressed that he's actually been making use of it. So it turns out in the 5 days that we kind of jumped over, Light has been busy. And Ryuk informs him that it's his note now. Like, it's his notebook. He picked it up. And it's his. And if he doesn't want it anymore, he has to give it to somebody else. But if he does, he'll have all his memories erased of having had it and used it and stuff. And he's the only one that can see him. Like, you have to, he can see him because he touched the notebook, and that's why he can see and hear Ryuk. And they have this bond between them now. He's like, "Well, there's no price to pay for using this." He says, "There is, but he just says, don't think any human who's used the Death Note can go to heaven or to hell. That's all." And then there's just, like, several panels of silence between the two of them, and Light starts to laugh, and Ryuk says, "You'll find out about that after you die." And then so Light thinks maybe he was chosen. He's like, "No, you weren't chosen. I dropped it because I was bored." And it might sound like a weird thing to say, but really, Shinigami don't have that much to do. Like, we just nap or gamble, it's, you know, so he basically just did it because he was bored. And then Light admits that he was bored too, and he didn't believe it was true at first, but he decided to try it. And when he decided to try it, though, the fact that he would be a murderer, he decided to, like, he tuned into the news, and he saw the name and face of a man who had killed 6 people and had barricaded himself inside of a nursery school with 8 hostages, including little children. So he wrote that guy's name down, And like 40 seconds later, which is what the note said would happen, the hostages started to come out of the school, and the news reported that the man died. And so he's like, well, maybe it was just a coincidence. So, you know, then after that, you know, he tried it again and continued to find, like, people that were, like, criminals or harassing people and stuff like that. And, you know, he experimented with before. He, like, wrote someone's name down and specified that they would die in a traffic accident. And sure enough, as he's standing there, this guy on this motorcycle that's harassing this woman gets just absolutely wrecked by a truck. So he becomes convinced at that point. He's killed two people. And he does wrestle with the morality of it, but then he starts, you know, it's like, you know, I've been feeling this way all along. Like, the world's a rotten mess and somebody needs to clean it up. And maybe I'm the one to do it. Like, I have the power to do that now. And so over this intervening time, he's resolved himself to do it. And he's been just writing the names of all the world's most brutal criminals that he sees on the TV and on the internet. So he continues, it goes back to the present, he's continuing to discuss it with Ryuk. he says, ultimately said, you know, his plan is basically, people maybe will eventually realize that people who are bad, who are evil, are dying, and maybe people will start to act better. And Rook says, you know, if you do something like that, eventually the only person left that's has a bad personality will be you. And he says, what are you talking about? I'm a serious straight-A student, a model teenager, and I will reign over a new world. And then the first chapter ends with it doesn't quite end yet, but the last we see of these two in the chapter is Ryuk thinking, I was right, humans are fun. And then the last couple pages are there to introduce the one other important character for a while. There's a meeting of Interpol, and they're discussing that that 52 people in the last 52 criminals in the last week have died from cardiac arrest, and a lot of them, most of them, are behind bars, and there's the number might even be higher than that. So, and then we see that there's another young man sitting on a floor in front of a computer, thinks to himself, "Well, Interpol's finally starting to move on this. This is one case where I'm going to need some help from the police." And that we'll learn in the next chapter is a young man that just goes by the name of L, as in Larry. That's not his name, but that just, so you know what I'm saying. And it sets up this, like, they're both brilliant young men, and it sets up a mystery, like a suspense story of Light using the Death Note and L trying to track him down, and it just they just pour on, like, the complexities from there. Light's father is a high-ranking police officer, so that complicates things, and he ends up involved in the efforts to track down this who they come to know. They start calling the whoever is killing people as Kira. He becomes involved in the efforts to try to track down this Kira. another, someone else finds a different Death Note, and later on, and it just becomes more and more complex. And like I said, I'm only about halfway through, but you know, there's, and I think why I hadn't tried it before, there's a little bit of a gimmickiness about the setup, you know, and how there's certain rules about how you can use it and things like that. But ultimately, though, it's not really any more than a lot of other similar premises. And the way that it's the authors are really good at creating the suspense, which I say authors because one other thing that's different about Japanese comics is tends to be they tend to be written and drawn by the same person. They might have assistants and stuff because of the like pace at which they're produced. If they're big enough, they'll have assistants to get things done in time. But this actually is done by two guys. One writes it and one illustrates it, which is actually less common when it comes to manga. But Tsugumi Obata is the writer, and the illustrator is Takeshi Obata. And they seem to have continued to work together on some other series after this. But yeah, it's been it's one of those where you're like, I'm just going to read the next chapter because they're really good at like keeping up the suspense and just continuing to like, and it's interesting to see Light go down this path of like justifying himself and the way that it changes him. So
how do you want me to record this, like Death Note, or do you want me to Shonen Jump issue number?
You could just say that I talked about Death Note.
Okay. But it's not that's full thing, right?
What I talked about just now is, so you could say chapter one.
Okay.
I just talked about chapter one, and then
I just
was what I actually
it has
covered.
A lot.
Yeah, one out of, I mean, I would say, I don't know. I'm sure people have, like,
They'll
analyzed
probably go
this
by
more,
the volumes, but you can't.
Death Note has its own comic book. True. Is it the same thing or no?
It might be.
Yeah, I mean, manga it just means comic in Japanese, and they're published, like I said, they're published anthology, like in so this chapter would have appeared with chapters of other stories by different authors in an issue of Shonen Jump, but then they collect them into books of I think 6 or 7 chapters.
Gotcha.
Those are those like smaller manga books that you see like at Barnes and Nobles and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we get over here. Mostly is the collections. So the first volume of Death Note would be like the first 6 or 7 chapters, and I just talked about chapter one.
Gotcha. Okay, that makes sense.
And all together, it's like 108 chapters, however many volumes that ends up at.
I'm impressed, Chris. I didn't even know you knew Japanese.
I know some words, but no, I didn't. I did read it in English.
Oh. Whose turn is it? Is it my turn?
Yeah.
It is?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, how nice. All right, the next one that I've got is also Marvel, Mike. It's Marvel Fanfare number 33. And I read this one because it's one of the few Chris Claremont X-Men stories that I probably have not already read. I don't know what you guys know about Quest Probe.
It's a video game.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't know it was a video game.
It was I played it on the Commodore 64.
Did you?
Yeah.
Well, it was a
computer game.
It was also a comic book.
It had a Hulk Quest Probe, and there was a Spider-Man Quest Probe, I remember.
It's the comic book is only 3 issues, and I wonder if it should have been 4, and they just ended up not continuing it, and then this issue ended up coming out later as a Marvel fanfare, because he says right at the beginning that this was like a file story that they had that had never come out before. But it involves Quest Probe in that. I don't
remember. I actually own those issues.
I only have issue number 3, and that's it.
Plus I played the game. I think the one I played had Spider-Man in it.
It was more
of a one of those video adventure games, kind of like where you choose your path.
Was it like all like was it text?
Yeah. I mean, there was some graphics, but it was mostly where are you going to go, you know?
Right.
You run into this situation, what's going to happen? What do you do? Kind of like they showed that documentary on Netflix, you know?
Yeah.
When they were talking about them.
I had a bunch of those back in, you know, with the Commodore, like you said. You would say, pick up sword, stuff like that. Stuff like that. But this was pretty cool. It's definitely part of that Quest Probe storyline of the comics that they had. And it's set at the time where Professor X has given reins of the school to Magneto, and also if you're not familiar, earlier in the run, Magneto had found this strange island that had obviously been inhabited many, many years ago, but was abandoned. It had weird architecture and so forth. It almost looked like a type of Atlantis without it being Atlantis. And he raised it up from the ocean floor, so he has his own island. So the premise of this story is that the X-Men are currently hanging out and almost taking like a vacation on this island that Magneto raised. And at the time, the X-Men that are around are Wolverine, Kitty Pryde, Storm, Colossus, and Rogue. Magneto is there as well, and he, and I don't remember this happening, but I haven't read this era in a while, but apparently he's been seeing Lee Forrester, who I know had some interaction with Cyclops just prior to issue 200 of that series. But anyhow, they're hanging out, they're relaxing, and the different statues, the statues are like kind of grotesque. They're all like weird looking monsters and stuff like that. Well, they end up coming to life and start attacking the X-Men. And as soon as it touches you, the hero turns to stone. So very quickly, Storm immediately gets touched. Kitty has the idea because this is, even though these are statues, they're like sophisticated circuitry that is part of this very advanced yet ancient island. So she knows that when she walks through things that are electronic, she can cause them to go haywire. So that's her idea. She goes running through one of these creatures, but instead of her affecting it, it affects her and she turns to stone and falls into the pool. Colossus is worried about that, and he goes to try to rescue Kitty from the pool, where he sees across from the pool, Wolverine is distracted by the fact that Kitty's fallen in, and a creature hits him from behind, and he immediately turns to stone and goes flying, like literally off the island into the ocean somewhere. In the heat of the battle, Colossus turns to steel, punches one of the creatures and turns to stone. And Lee Forrester is turned to stone as well. That leaves only Magneto. And he's holding his own. He sees that he can't touch these things. So he's picking up anything that has metal, and he's destroying these creatures with all of the with all the things that he's using. When suddenly that strange quest probe villain called the Chief Examiner, he's the one with like the fishbowl helmet like Mysterio has, he shows up and he offers him congratulations because he had an evaluation of that group and he's the most powerful, and he requires him to pass through his scanner, which is this big rectangle like void in the sky. And so Magneto refuses to go through and uses all of his power against it, and it causes quite a display from even miles out, and it cuts to Rogue on a speedboat coming back to the island after having done some shopping, and boom, splash, she sees a stone Wolverine splash right next to her boat and sink. So she dives in, grabs him, and puts him in the boat and flies quickly to the island to see what's going on. And as she gets there, she sees that only Magneto is still about, and he's acting strangely, and he's holding the robes and helmet of that Chief Examiner, and he starts attacking Rogue. And it's quickly very apparent that whatever he did to that that portal backfired, and now he's being possessed by the Chief Examiner. So they start getting into it. He actually knocks her into this void scanner, and she doesn't go through. She gets kind of like stuck on it, and she pulls herself off, and suddenly she's the color green, and she finds that she has the Hulk's powers. She jumps and sticks to the side of a wall and suddenly knows that something's coming at her and jumps out of the way. She has Spider-Man's powers. She is, as she jumps out of the way, she decides to start flying, which turns her into a fire being like the Human Torch. So, Mike, if you look at the database for Quest Probe, you'll see that those first three issues are the Hulk, Spider-Man, and the Fantastic Four. So that's why I'm convinced that this was going to be a fourth issue.
But the fact that he's in there too. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And it's
referencing. It was probably like a really low selling.
It had
comic been. Book. It was probably horrible.
But by her attaching herself to that scanner, she's now absorbed the powers of those other heroes that he's encountered in those previous issues. So she's you know, got a lot of power. But she's just running for her life at this point because she's not sure what exactly is going on with Magneto. We cut to this weird, strange land where Magneto himself is now there as like energy, like his consciousness is there. And he sees another being who's really starting to, his own consciousness is starting to fade. And he tells the backstory of who he is and the fact that this was a planet that him and a lot of other people were on. They were going to be attacked by a bunch of aliens called the Black Fleet. However, their own society totally did not subscribe to aggression and had no weapons. They also did not believe in trying to enlist anyone else to try to help them as well. So they were kind of stuck. He decided that this was exceptional times and that he needed to seek out the most powerful beings to fight off the Black Fleet. However, what happened at the time is that the computer that cared for their entire world malfunctioned, and that it's the computer that is now this Chief Examiner. So Magneto has the idea that with his powers, that he's got, you know, the magnetism powers, that perhaps he can do something to realign the computer itself, to help his this guy's world. So it cuts back and forth between what's going on with Magneto and what's going on with Rogue as she's flipping from one power to the next. She realizes that Magneto is possessed, that she doesn't want to actually hurt him too badly, but she needs to stop him. She ends up collapsing some buildings around her, around him in his quest probe guise. Yeah, in such a way that it's buried him without actually hurting him too badly. Back in the other world, Magneto has realized that if they combine their essences, that they should be able to breach some broken circuitry from one end to another and realign the computer on the world. And that's just what they end up doing. Once that happens, Magneto actually can get through, and he gets back through this scanner, and they talk to you know, they have more of a discussion now with the chief examiner, who now is working, you know, not malfunctioning anymore. And the chief examiner reverses everyone, so they're no longer stone, but they're flesh and blood again. And he goes back to the world to continue to help the guy that Magneto was talking to, and to do what they can to fend off that Black Fleet that's on their way. And so that's the end of this story. As I said, this is probably one of the only Claremont X-Men stories, especially from that era, that I hadn't read. And in the back, there are a bunch of pinups, as they usually had in fanfare, and there's some cool ones. There's a real cool Conan one of his fighting some sort of weird, almost like a werewolf creature, but he's fighting them in a big chamber of, you know, gold coins and treasure. And there's a huge mirror, and Conan's kind of looking out of the side of his side view into the mirror. And it looks like that he's fighting nothing in the mirror. So whatever this monster is, does not cast a reflection. There's a cool picture of Dr. Doom, Dr. Strange, one of Iron Fist fighting somebody, a cool one of Elektra, Punisher, and lastly, one of Iron Man in his red and white armor out in outer space. So this was a cool one. I really enjoyed reading this. Really read exactly like, you know, those Claremont issues back then. Obviously it would, because he was the writer of this too. So this is like a lost story that I had, but I just hadn't gotten around to reading. So it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I got to finish that Marvel Fanfare at some point. I have like almost all of it except for issue 2 and then the last, I don't know, 10 issues or so.
Oh, really? I literally might have 5 issues of this series.
Yeah, it's cool. It was cool at the time because it was one of those first comics that started the different paper.
Yeah.
It was one of direct market only kind of comics.
I think I covered those Black Widow ones on one of our episodes.
Yeah, they're reprinting that one too.
Yeah.
I think they facsimiled that edition, the George Perez cover.
Yeah, those are beautiful, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
what else do you got?
My last one is Chamber of Darkness, number 4.
Oh, whoa.
This is a Marvel comic. It only got my interest because of Marvel Conan. And I found out that this was like the Marvel Conan prototype, Star the Slayer. But it has four comics in it. You have Kirby work, which is, God, that's probably my favorite story of the bunch. It's a Stan Lee. Well, actually, this is a fully, the story and script and art is all by Jack Kirby. And then on the second one, it's Tom Hutton and Denny O'Neill. So you got some big names on this. And then you have Roy Thomas and Barry Windsor Smith. That's what how you got the Conan prototype, Star of the Slayer, and I think there was another story. No, that was it. There's a long letters page. But the first story is kind of like a Frankenstein story. It had God, it's beautiful. Well, you have to love Jack Kirby in order to think it's beautiful. But from if you're a Kirby fan, this has got Kirby crackle all over the place and the stylistic stuff of the 70s Kirby, which is probably my favorite Kirby. It's the story of this guy. He kind of looks like he's part ape, part man. He's only got one eye, and he's treated like a monster, but he's very well-to-do. His name is Andreas Fleck. He's well-dressed, well-groomed. People make fun of him, call him ugly. He's treated like a monster. They call him a monster. And so he's very bitter towards people in the town. And he goes to find a music box. He buys this music box that he had custom made. And even the guy is that's selling him the music box has to tell his wife, you know, you should have held your tongue, woman. It's not wise to anger such a man, because she called him a monster. And he looked, what did she say? On the music that played in the music box, it's none that we have heard before. It seems to cast a spell. She's a very bitter woman, even though they sold him a music box. And then he goes back to his place, and he's got a beautiful woman there, sitting in a chair, but she never says a word, never says anything, and he plays the music box for her. And later on, the townspeople are like, let's kill this guy. He's got a woman captive. They look in his window, see him captive. And a lot of townspeople come. He goes to his gun arsenal, pulls out a gun to protect himself, and the woman that's there, they come crashing in and shoot him dead. And they find out that this woman is a mannequin, and it was his only companion, and he was trying to protect the mannequin. It's kind of like a sad Frankenstein monster type story. And you feel very sorry for this guy. Like, he just wanted to be left alone, and he was killed because he was different, and he had no companionship. So his only companionship was this mannequin. So it was a pretty sad story. And then the story and the Denny O'Neill, Tom Sutton, is called The Man Who Owned the World. And it's a story about this rich, rich guy. And he finds out about this technologies to cryogenically freeze you. And he wants to live forever. And he's old. He's like in his 90s. And he basically buys this scientist to stop his work and come work for him, because he wants to know about the suspended animation process. And he tanks the money market, because he takes all his money and pockets it into the bank and stops all his businesses. So a lot of people are out of work. A lot of people are angry. He hires this scientist to make this stuff. Meanwhile, there's a lot of people across. He like controls a lot of the money. So a lot of people are starving. A lot of people don't have jobs. And he doesn't care. He just wants to live forever. And then when he comes back out of freeze, he wants to have all this money that earn interest. And a huge check. But little does he know that he ends up, he comes out and the world is gone. And the scientist that invented the machine took everybody out into space because the Earth was no longer inhabitable. And he ended up dying because he couldn't breathe the air. It was one of those Iron Man stories.
Whoops.
And then Star of the Slayer, which is why I bought the book in the first place, because it had the
did
Roy
you
Thomas.
Did you recently buy this one, or did you had it for?
Okay. Yeah, I bought it about 2 months ago. I will say that it is one of the best eBay purchases I've ever done, because this guy graded it a VG, and man, it looks like a VF. It's a beautiful wow. book. It's really nice looking. And this Star of the Slayer, he's opens up like he's fighting this demon beast Zardath with this sword, and it's very hard to defeat this Zardath, but he, this demon he fights, and then there's this sorcerer, so he takes out the sorcerer by reflecting his sword. The sorcerer like shoots a fireball at him, and the sword reflects the fireball, and his name is Troll, the sorcerer that he takes down. And then all of a sudden you're in current time, and this guy wakes up and he's like, oh man, another nightmare. I got to call my editor. I got to stop writing this story of Star of the Slayer, because it keeps giving me nightmares. So it's like he's writing the story of this guy, Star of the Slayer. And he calls the editor and says, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to kill this guy off, because I can't sleep at night anymore. And the editor's like, you can't do that. And he goes, what do you mean? This is my own creation. And he goes, nope, we don't want to have your story where you kill this character. We want him to go on. And so he's pretty angry about the whole situation. And later on, he's just he's getting his story. He wants to turn in his final story to the editor, and he's going to kill him off because he owns the property. And Star the Slayer shows up in his current time, and he says, murder. And he's like, who the devil are you? You're Star. And he goes, yeah, and I hear you're going to destroy me. And Star the Slayer ends up killing his creator. So it's a really interesting story, because he kills the writer. And Star the Slayer goes on to live on forever. So a very unusual story. But, man, this comic book was outstanding. And the letters pages from issue 2 said they were a lot of complaints. There were a lot of people writing in. There wasn't one really positive note. So a lot of people must have not liked it. Yeah, they didn't I don't know. Not in this particular issue. Cause
no, but for a couple issues.
Yeah, a couple issues ago. There was an 18-year-old that says, I've been collecting comics forever, and this is one of the worst horror comics I've ever read.
Jeez.
They were complaining about the art and all this stuff. And
well, we know that it didn't last long. But
yeah. This was I thought it was a gem, but maybe they picked up an issue 4. Because, you had Tom Sutton, and you had Jack Kirby, and Barry Windsor Smith. I mean,
you got
some big names. I mean, I don't know what the previous issues were, but I did, because of this issue, I did pick up issue 1 too. So I'm going to give that a read.
I didn't realize that this time, I'm just looking in the database, that it didn't get canceled. It switched to be called Monsters on the Prowl. Because I've got some Monsters on the Prowl, but
yeah,
I don't know.
I do have some of those, yeah.
Pretty cool.
Yep, that's all I read for this.
Chris, do you have another one? I've got just one. I got a movie to talk about, but do you have anything, Chris?
Nope.
All right, then I'll just tell you what I watched the last couple nights. I had to break it up because I fell asleep the night before. But I watched The Bad Seed from 1956. Have either of you seen this movie?
No.
I'd heard of it before and stuff, but I'd never seen it before. So basically, what it is it's this little girl. She's 8 years old. Her mom and dad, it's like a 50s suburban setting. The dad is in the military, and at the beginning, he's got to go down to Washington, D.C. for an indeterminate amount of time, might be a month or two or something. And so it's just the mom and the little girl. And the little girl's pretty upset that she lost some sort of penmanship award to one of her classmates, this boy named Claude. The little girl's name is Rhoda. And she's just saying that, you know, it wasn't fair that she's got the best penmanship. She wanted the medal. Very upset. But anyhow, they have a class picnic that afternoon, and the mom drives the Rhoda out to the thing, meets the teacher. The mother's asking like questions like, you know, is she popular? Is she, you know, do the other kids like her? And the teacher's like, oh, yes, but, yeah, you know, and then she said, well, you know, is she a popular girl? And she said, well, you know, she's very serious. She's, you know, she really is maybe some, you know, too serious for some of the other children, but, you know, she gets along well enough. Prior to them going to the, to the picnic, there's an aunt that lives upstairs that absolutely adores little Rhoda. There's a creepy like groundskeeper who like just walks into the house to do things all the time. What he does is he rings the bell and he immediately walks in every single time. So he doesn't wait for somebody to come and say come in. But he's very creepy, and it's very apparent that he and the little girl don't get along at all. Like she was saying some nasty things to him. He acted like he pretended he was watering the garden. He acted like he pretended to turn and accidentally soak her shoes, and you know, it's obvious that he did it on purpose, and that they don't like each other. So mom goes back home. There's this big scene off screen. Nothing is shown. You hear about it after the fact that little boy who won the penmanship medal, he drowned in the pond there. And apparently Rhoda was one of the last to see him. But Rhoda comes home. She's like, oh yes, I know. I know that he died. I saw the, it acts like she just, she couldn't care less. So then more information starts coming through, and that, you know, his penmanship medal was not on him. He had been wearing it, but it's gone. So when the girl's out reading, the mother becomes suspicious enough that she starts looking through the girl's bedroom, and in the girl's jewelry case is the penmanship medal. So she confronts the little girl. The little girl says, no, I found it on the ground. Yes, we were arguing, but you know, he was off by himself, off on the pier where we're not supposed to be, and I don't know what happened to him. You know, all of this. So then she's out outside again, and the creepy groundskeeper, they're talking, and he's teasing her, saying, oh, I bet you, you know, you didn't like that boy, did you? I bet you killed him. And she's, you know, gets really offended, starts yelling at him and stuff. And it's like, I know you did it, and you think that you're so smart, but you know, the police have ways of checking for blood even after you've washed and washed and washed. Like, they put powder on that. And like, you know, he's just, honestly, he's being a jerk. He doesn't actually believe that she has anything to do with it. But she starts asking her mom questions about, is it true that they can detect blood and stuff like that? And she asks her why. She goes, oh no, I just heard the police talking about it at the park when during the picnic. And so she said she doesn't really know, but she's having a visitor that night. Anyhow, the next morning, she catches out of the corner of her eye Rhoda with a bag. And she's walking. She makes a point not to go through the living room that her mom's in, but to go the other way directly into the kitchen that leads to the outside. So mom quickly gets up and stops her. Says, "What do you have in the bag? What do you have in the bag?" And the girl's like flipping out. She's screaming, carrying on. Finally, she gets the bag. It's the girl's shoes, and she had worn through part of her heels. So instead of buying new shoes, they actually put like a metal on the back of those shoes, and almost like a tap dance shoe. And so she was using it as tap dancing earlier. And he's like, why are you throwing this out? Why are you, why? She's going to the incinerator to throw out her shoes. And finally, she gets the girl to admit that, yes, she killed the boy. She hit him with the metal part of his shoes because he wouldn't give the metal. And finally, he gave it to her. But then he said he was going to tell. So she pushed him into the water. She hit him and he fell into the water, rather. And she's like, well, why did he have marks not on it, only on his face, but on his hands? And she said, well, because he swam back up to the pier and he said he was going to tell on me. So I had to keep hitting his hands until he let go. And that's how he drowned. So this girl's like a total psychopath. It's funny because there's an extra little bit that I don't think was needed at all, but it turns out when the mother's father comes to visit that this whole dialogue went on for probably a good 20 minutes on talking to him and finally in saying that she never felt like that, you know, that she was really theirs, that, you know, her mom and dad's and stuff like that. And finally gets her dad to admit that she was adopted and that her mom was a serial killer. So the whole point of the actual movie is it the environment that you grow up in? Is it a genetic, a combination of those, so on and so forth? The father wanted to believe that everything is just by environment, that nothing could be genetic. But of course, his daughter was adopted and now has this little girl, Rhoda. So the groundskeeper ends up telling Rhoda that he grabbed the shoes out of the incinerator before they got burned up, and that before he had been just teasing, but he's like, I know you really did it. I'm going to the police. So she ends up locking the door to the basement, and he likes to sleep, take naps down there on that, you know, the straw stuff that they used to pack things in so they didn't get broken in shipments. He uses that as like a bed down there. And so she lights it on fire and locks the door. So by the time he's screaming and stuff and anyone gets the door open, he comes running out. Again, none of this is on screen. You're just hearing him shrieking and screaming, which is almost worse than like not even seeing it. And he ends up dying from the burns right there in their yard as the girl is playing the piano like faster and faster and frantically, more and more frantic, where it's like matching like the level of his screams. It was really effective and actually disturbing without you actually even seeing anything. Finally, the mom figures that she just doesn't know what to do. She doesn't feel like she can bring the bring her daughter to the police and stuff. But the aunt upstairs had given, because she could tell that the mom was very distressed, gave her a bunch of vitamins and also sleeping pills. So she told that her daughter Rhoda that these were vitamins, and she had her take a good 4 or 5 sleeping pills to actually kill her. So she takes her into bed, closes the girl's door, walks into her bedroom, closes the bedroom door, and you hear a gun blast. The next scene is at the hospital, and you find that the mother is actually still alive. That shotgun blast had gotten the attention of the aunt. She came running downstairs, called the ambulance, and they talk about, well, you know, the lethal dose of sleeping pills, and the father's back, of course, because of the situation, and the aunt's like, well, thank God she used a gun, because that blast, you know, we ran downstairs and we were able to save Rhoda's life as well. And here she comes walking into the thing, happy as can be. The father and daughter and Rhoda go back home, saying, you know, the doctor said, you know, we'll let you know when, you know, if anything happens with your wife, because she's in a coma. And it turns out that she ends up recovering as well. And they briefly talk on the phone. And the last part is the father tucking her, his darling girl into bed, and her sharing with the father that her aunt upstairs said that, you know, when she dies, that she'll pass on the birds that she has upstairs. She goes, well, and he goes, well, that's nice, but, you know, I mean, your aunt's not going to die anytime soon. She says, oh, she's not? He said, no. And she said, well, how long do these birds live? Do they live as long as people? And the dad said, no, not at all. She goes, well, I guess I'll have to go see when I go visit my aunt tomorrow morning, like with a smile on her face. And like that's the end. So you know that that aunt's going to be in trouble tomorrow. It was really interesting. As it went on towards the end, I thought it could have ended a couple different ways. I thought it definitely could have ended with just that mother closing the door and the shotgun blast, and that could have been the end of the movie. It also could have been the end at the hospital, where you see that the little girl survived, and you could, and it could be like maybe the mom didn't, and the dad has no idea that his daughter's a psychopath. So I found it interesting that they kept going with more of a conclusion with, you know, what happened to the mom and stuff like that, and bringing the daughter back home and so on and so forth. I'm not sure if I liked it quite as much as if they maybe would have ended it a little earlier, but it was definitely interesting. And I can imagine in 1956, very shocking with a child psychopath, and also the fact that it actually, you know, even though it was very peaceful with sleeping pills, have a mom actually on the silver screen actually poison her child with the intent to kill her. So it was, I'm sure those were very shocking issues back in the 50s there. But it was well worth watching the movie. I enjoyed it. And that's all I got.
Cool deal. Anything else?
No, but I think I just heard Chris's stomach rumbling.
He's probably hungry.
Sorry, Chris.
Martin and Nick turned vegan.
That's insane. Both of them did at the same time?
At the same time. Well, Nick is more driven because of his wife, because, you know, conditions, but... Martin's just doing it. But Martin does all that stuff. Do you know what I mean? Like, he goes on these tangents where he's on keto, and then he does that for a couple months, and now he's doing vegan. But he's been vegan before. Out of college, he was doing vegan.
But he's
all over the
Nick
map.
Nick was eating all those turkey sausages and stuff. Like, no more turkey sausages.
No, he had chicken and turkey sausages. He had to get rid of them. He had to give them to his mom and other people, and go this vegan route.
Wow. That's tough.
Yeah, I would imagine. I would have a rough time for sure, because
I don't
enjoy anything much except salads. Maybe that's. But even when I do salads, I like to have meat on it, like some kind of lunch meat or chicken or something. So,
I could probably do vegetarian, but I don't think I could do
vegan, because then you can't have milk or anything either.
Cheese or fish or
egg
anything.
Or anything, yeah.
Yeah. Chris wouldn't know anything about that, though.
Yeah. He's a specialist. I can't remember. You eat fish, though, right?
Yeah.
You're like Bill. Do you have milk or no?
I'll have dairy, but I don't really like cow's milk anymore. I usually do almond milk, but I'll still have like cheese and
ice cream
sometimes, and ice cream and stuff. Mm. That's more just what I prefer at this point.
Yeah.
I might have to go that route. But not by choice. All right. Well, you've been listening to Geek Brunch Retrocast. Rob is at Rob Krieger. I'm at Mike Myers Brunch. At Mythmaking ETC is Chris. And you can find us at geekbrunchpodcast.com and also on Facebook at Geek Brunch Podcast. I think that's it. But Rob, if you have the latest My Comic Shop code word, can you send it to me? I am going to place an order.
I don't know what that means.
You don't know what the special code word is?
No.
You don't get. You're not on their mailing list. You get like 5 to 10% off.
I had no idea. I guess I got to get on their mailing list because I bought. I mean, I've bought stuff from them many times.
Yeah,
I'm not
you're
on
crazy to not be on their mailing list.
I didn't
list.
Know there was such a thing.
Every week you get a different sale. Like they might have like DC A through D or something like that, or Marvel.
Let me sign up on their mailing list. Maybe they'll send me something right away. If they do, I'll text you.
Yeah, I erased I'm mine by accident.
Yeah, I'm not playing.
I didn't know I was going to place an order this week until I read the War Man, and now I want to buy it, and I can't wait. I want to just read it.
Ah, here, join our mailing list. I found it. I'll go ahead and I'll sign up. And if I get anything today, I'll send it to you.
I'm trying to find all the Todd McFarlane stuff, too. Like, did you know he did so many covers of Marvel Tales, the reprint?
Uh-uh.
Oh, man, they look awesome. Oh, crap.
Yeah, no, I didn't. I had no idea. Yeah.
All right, well, you guys have a good Sunday, and we'll talk to you in 2 weeks, hopefully.
Sounds good to me.
Enjoy your Sunday. Take care, guys.
Bye.
Okay. Bye. Bye.